In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, a conversation with retired U.S. Navy SEAL Commander Dan O'Shea, who served as coordinator for the hostage working group at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. We discuss ongoing talks between Israel and Hamas over the release of hostages. Then Republicans in both the House and Senate say tougher border measures are needed in order to pass any kind of aid to Ukraine and Israel. We talk with Lindsay McPherson, political reporter at The Messenger, about what's being considered. Plus, Regina LaBelle, former acting National Drug Control Policy Director in the Biden administration, discusses how federal, state, and local governments are responding to the fentanyl crisis in the United States.
We assume you're here because you enjoy listening to C-SPAN's podcasts. If you're a regular listener, please consider supporting our nonprofit operation so we can continue to bring you quality public affairs podcasts like these. Visit cspan.org/donate to learn more.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, the conversation with Dan O'Shea, former hostage negotiator and Navy SEAL commander, about the dynamics that could be at play in the talks between Hamas and Israel over the release of hostages.
We want to welcome to the program Dan O'Shea, former Navy SEAL commander, and he was also the former coordinator for the hostage working group in Baghdad. He served in that position from 2004 to 2006. Mr. O'Shea, thanks for giving us your time this morning.
My pleasure being with you.
Can we start first to tell us about your experiences in Baghdad when it comes to the issue of the hostages and negotiation, and then parallel that to things you're seeing today about what's going on between Israel and Hamas on the same front?
Sure. So I arrived in Baghdad in July of 2004. It was a couple weeks after the Nickberg kidnapping and beheading that ended up airing on Al Jazeera. And it was literally first day on the job. I showed up. I was an 04 lieutenant commander. I was a interagency liaison officer from U.S. Central Command. And one of my first morning meetings with the Paul Mill ambassador and his staff, there was a topic of two Bulgarian truck drivers that had been kidnapped in Mosul. And because Bulgaria was in the coalition of the willing, there was roughly 40-odd nations in the coalition supporting the U.S. in the mission to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And this was a year later. I'd been involved. I was in Iraq earlier for the invasion. And now a year later, we came back and we're trying to build a stable democracy. And Bulgaria, two Bulgarian truck drivers were kidnapped in Mosul. And because Bulgaria was in the coalition, President Bush had called the president of Bulgaria that morning and said, hey, you're a valued member of the coalition. We'll do everything we can to save the lives of these two hostages. He said, two envoys are flying in today to Baghdad. We need to brief them and tell them everything the U.S. is doing to save the lives of these two. So the State Department chief of staff, who was reading off the list of items, looked at the only military guy in the room and said, Dan, you're a Navy SEAL. Go call your friends. And that's ultimately how I got tagged with the kidnapping stink, as you call it in the military, when you get handed that project. And that one kidnapping ended up evolving into the next 2 years of my life and ultimately about 448 international kidnappings over that time period, which was basically I got a PhD in Islamic terrorism. And ultimately, why kidnapping is such an effective tool for them. And I've been studying what I call hostage terrorism now for almost 20 years. And, I always use this anecdote that we went into Iraq looking for weapons of mass destruction that we never found. But the real weapon of mass effect was the hostage taking. And Al-Qaeda and a number of other groups use that to the great advantage, spreading terror, using propaganda, getting concessions. And what we're seeing today by Hamas is virtually the same. It's just the next level. And again, we've never seen anything to the scale and scope of Gaza, with maybe the exception of the Beslan school crisis when a school was taken over by a number of Chechen terrorists, IMU. And now we're seeing this on the world stage. And The weapon of mass effect is hostage taking. And terrorist organizations and rogue regimes like even North Korea and China and Russia This is how they negotiate with the West, is they grab someone, someone from ideally the United States, which is obviously we're seeing on the stage how powerful that was for them. And it's just a continuation on. And people need to understand Hamas has been at this kidnapping game for a very long time. In fact, when the Marines went into Fallujah for the second time in the fall of 2004, they found one of the hostages where these hostage holding sites where hostages had been killed. And they found a kidnapping manual from Hamas. And the title on this kidnapping document that read like a field manual for the army, the title on the manual stated, "No need to hunt for lions when there are plenty of sheep to be had." So this is the Hamas grabbing grandparents, grandchildren, 85-year-old men and women, 10-month-old babies, pregnant women. This was in their strategy from the get-go. And look what we have right now. The whole hostage crisis has, you know, brought a ceasefire about, and it's why they did it, and they're doing it very effectively in the world stage.
How would you then, with your experiences to inform you, how would you then characterize the exchanges that have taken place over the last few days?
Well, the reality is this negotiated settlement that was been ongoing in Gaza, Qatar, through multiple parties, but not Israel and Hamas directly across the table. They are both sworn to wipe each other out. So this was all done through, you know, cutouts, third-party mediators, including the Emir of Qatar, non-government organizations like the Red Cross, Red Crescent, representatives, diplomats, and all sides have been putting pressure on Hamas and Israel and Netanyahu's government and his cabinet. And you can be sure the IDF, they did not want this ceasefire because they've lost some momentum. And which is exactly why Hamas grabbed these hostages in the first place. They are their only bargaining chip in this process, in the war, that in world opinion.
Mr. O'Shea, are there rules of the road when it comes to hostage negotiation? And are those being played out as you're seeing what's going on currently?
Well, you know, there was a rule of thumb in Iraq. You know, the bottom line is we focused on hostage rescue. In fact, the hostage working group, its charter specifically had three priorities: safe rescue recovery of hostages, prevent future kidnappings, and bring those responsible to justice. So yes, we did get involved in some backdoor negotiations, but our focus was on hostage rescue because at the time, U.S. policy was we will not negotiate with terrorists. That's never been U.S. policy, even though that was the presumed policy. But our policy was, when I was in Iraq, was we do not make concessions to terrorism. So when terrorist groups grab someone in Iraq, they knew they couldn't directly go face to face and try and negotiate, quote, a settlement for that hostage. It did happen, but it was the exception to the rule. In this state today, you have President Biden talking about the head of the CIA going over to negotiate this. Blinken has made multiple trips, and what it's done is it's raised the stakes of the game, which is exactly why Hamas grabbed American hostages and why they're holding on to them, because there's 40-odd countries represented in the nationalities, and those diplomats have been all making trips to Doha to try and get their people out. But the guy carrying the big stick is President Biden. And by making public statements about his direct role in this, he's raised the price of admission to get these hostages out, at least the American side. And so it's a very dangerous tightrope that we're seeing portrayed out, because to date, only one American, to my knowledge, a young child, a 4-year-old girl, who both parents were murdered on October 7th. She just was released, but she's the only American to date. So there is no rules of how this plays. Every hostage negotiation is different. Obviously, both sides have demands, and then they have to come down from them. But it's a back and forth, and we've seen the original start of the ceasefire got extended, you know, pushed back 15 minutes because of an airstrike that was going on into the ceasefire. So this is, like I said, both sides want certain demands and they're having to make concessions, but there is no one blueprint for hostage negotiation. Every situation is different. And honestly, what's going on in Gaza and in the backdoor channels in Egypt and in Doha, there's been nothing like it in previous history in this game.
You talked about the president making the statements about his role, William Burns over there doing the same as far as negotiations. Also, the Qataris are involved in this. Why have they served a prominent role in your thinking?
Well, Qatar, this is not the first time. They've become the Switzerland of the Middle East. Not only are they the banking for the Middle East, where a lot of terrorism financing goes through, they're off limits. We've known that for years. Qatar, certainly the Gulf states, where all the money's coming out of and financing terrorism around the world, unfortunately, that they're left alone. You never hear about terrorist incidents in Qatar or the Gulf states generally, and it's for a reason. But Qatar has taken a lead role, not only with the fact that Al Jazeera, the leading, you know, CNN of the world, is based in out of Qatar and started there over 20 odd years ago, but they've been doing this negotiation with diplomatic channels, and they have a strong relationship with the U.S. They were central to the role to get Bo Bergdahl released for five senior Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders that were held at Gitmo. So this isn't new territory for Qatar. The emir has played a direct role in this. And of course, he carries a big stick, because we know they're also been protecting and hosting Hamas leaders that are now, many of them are billionaires living in Qatar. So that's why Qatar was a natural for this, because they have a track record and history of accomplishing international behind-the-scenes settlements on hostage release.
That was Dan O'Shea, former Navy SEAL commander and U.S. hostage negotiator. Next, Lindsay McPherson, political reporter at The Messenger, gives an update on congressional efforts to provide U.S. aid to Israel and Ukraine, and Republicans' insistence that border security be part of the package.
So Congress has been debating for weeks about trying to get aid to Israel and Ukraine. Remind us about why the border negotiations are involved in that as well.
Right. So Republicans in both chambers have decided that they do not want to approve more aid, in particular for Ukraine, without border security measures. A lot of Republican voters, people they're hearing from and the districts back home, don't support Ukraine aid. And while some Republicans on Capitol Hill do, even those Republicans say that, you know, politically, they want to focus on securing our own borders before we help Ukraine secure theirs. And they think that, you know, is a political imperative for them. And also border security is a priority. And they see this package as a way to leverage that in a way that Democrats probably wouldn't negotiate on it otherwise, because Democrats feel strongly about the foreign aid portion.
And what are those border immigration policy proposals that are up for debate right now?
Right. So the main focus has been on restrictions to legal pathways that migrants use to enter the country, the asylum process and the parole process. These border crossings, you know, obviously have been high, and Republicans argue that these pathways, while they should exist legally, need to be, you know, curtailed some to limit the number of people trying to cross the border and claim asylum. They want to make it so that people who are claiming asylum, you know, can't be have their cases languished while they're set free in the country. They feel like the parole process has been used to basically people who would come in, and rather than claim asylum, they're granting them parole because they're overwhelmed with the number of asylum cases they have to process. And so they think that process is being abused, and they just want to overall put restrictions on those policies.
And what are Senate Democrats saying about that?
Senate Democrats are open to some minor changes to asylum, but they don't want to do anything that will look like they're trying to turn away immigrants. They want the U.S. to continue to be a welcome place for migrants, particularly people who need refuge from political and humanitarian crises in their own countries. And so they are cautious about going too far. And I think they've particularly resisted changes to the parole programs, which have been, you know, they are humanitarian programs, the parole issue. And so I think they have strong concerns about going too far, in particular to change these, to restrict these legal pathways without addressing other legal pathways that they have long held as a priority, wanting to overhaul the visa process for farm migrant labor workers, for example, or to provide pathways for undocumented immigrants in the country known as Dreamers, who were brought here as kids. And so they say, if, you know, Republicans want to go in one direction, we want to open these other things in the negotiation as well.
And then on the House side, what has Speaker Mike Johnson said about taking up a border deal from what the Senate GOP senators may agree to?
Right. So he had lunch with Senate Republicans this week on Wednesday, and he told them he doesn't think he can pass the big giant package, which would include the Ukraine aid, Israel aid, Taiwan aid as well, and the border policies, because Republicans and Democrats in the Senate are looking to package that all together. He said in the House, one big package isn't going to fly, that the House has already passed separate Israel aid, and that maybe he can package Ukraine and the border together, but he can't do a giant package. It has to be broken up a little bit if he's going to get it passed in his narrow majority.
And what's the timeline for lawmakers to get this done?
They want to get it done before the December holidays, but they are set to go on recess in 2 weeks for the December holidays, and that time is running short. Senator Schumer, the leader of the Senate, had said he might, as soon as next week, begin the floor process on the bill. But that's not certain at this point, and it will take some time once they have an agreement to move it through both the House and Senate. And it's not clear that they will get an agreement next week. Things are left yesterday, this when the Senate left on Thursday. Things were kind of stuck, as Lindsey Graham put it. He said the word stuck, and others said, things weren't progressing in the way that they had hoped.
That was Lindsay McPherson, political reporter for the news site The Messenger. Next, an update on drug addiction in the United States and government response to the fentanyl crisis with Regina LaBelle, former acting National Drug Control Policy Director in the Biden administration. She's now the director of the Addiction and Public Policy Initiative at Georgetown's O'Neill Institute.
Ms. LaBelle, this is the headline of a Politico story from last month that you're quoted in. The opioid crisis has gotten much, much worse despite Congress's efforts to stop it. What does that crisis look like in America today? What do the numbers tell us?
So I think the opioid overdose epidemic affects, hundreds of thousands of people annually. However, it's about 108,000 people die every year from overdoses, primarily driven by illegal fentanyl. So fentanyl is an opioid that's illegally manufactured, brought into the United States, and that's what's driving a lot of the overdose deaths in this country.
And why is it getting worse? Why have we not been able to get a handle on this crisis? It's not like we haven't known about it.
Right. So it's the supply. So the supply of drugs is a lot more lethal than it has been in the past. But we do have, substance use disorder in this country is not new. More people die actually from alcohol and alcohol use disorder annually than illegal drugs. But really, this is not a problem that we got into overnight, and it's not going to be solved overnight. We need to build out a whole prevention, treatment, harm reduction, recovery system that we don't currently have, and that's going to take a while.
We mentioned to our viewers that you serve as the Addiction and Public Policy Initiative Director at Georgetown University's O'Neill Institute. Should note, you are the former acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. What has the Biden administration been doing to build out those efforts to combat this issue?
All right. So I served on the transition team between administrations, and we spent a lot of time identifying what were the top things that needed to be done. So we hit the ground running. I started on the afternoon of Inauguration Day, and we put out our priorities in April of that year, many of which were expanding for the first time in this country, expanding harm reduction services. And that means, having more syringe services programs nationwide, having fentanyl test strips. A lot of people who were using opioids and thought they were using heroin were actually using fentanyl, illegal fentanyl. And so those test strips helped them identify what was in their drug supply so that they could either use safely or choose not to use. And we also have expanded, the administration expanded access to treatment by removing barriers to evidence-based treatment. And they're continuing to do a lot of that work today.
Just staying a second on needle exchanges and test strips. When we've talked about this issue before on this program, there have been callers who will call in and say, but that's enabling addiction. What do you say to those folks?
So it's all part of a continuum, right? We want to prevent substance use from ever happening, substance use disorders from ever happening. We need to treat substance use disorders. But there are people who are not yet in treatment, or perhaps they don't have a substance use disorder, but they need access to services like harm reduction services. There's a lot of evidence behind syringe services programs. It reduces blood-borne diseases like HIV and Hep C. Those are known and proven to work. They are a public health approach to this public health issue.
On getting the funding behind some of those public health approaches, what is the SUPPORT Act?
So the SUPPORT Act passed in 2018, right before the election in 2018. It's a 600-page document. It has a lot of authorized programs, some of which have gotten money through appropriations acts. It expanded access to in Medicare benefits to methadone, which is one of the evidence-based treatments for opioid use disorder. It's currently before Congress for reauthorization. At the time, it also reauthorized the Office of National Drug Control Policy, where I served in both the Biden and the Obama administrations. That's also up for reauthorization. So Congress is looking at that now, and hopefully they'll pass that, because it does have some pieces in it that need to continue and be reauthorized.
Why isn't that an automatic pass? What's holding it up?
Well, Congress has had a lot of things on its plate, and, you know, I'm hoping that we can restore regular order, we can have hearings, we can, you know, go through the process so that these types of programs are not only authorized, but also that we have an appropriations process that provides the funding for prevention, treatment, and recovery and harm reduction programs.
How soon does it need to be passed before some of these programs start not having the funding that they need?
So the continuing resolution has helped with some of that, so that some of the funding has been continued. There are a couple pieces, a couple access to treatment pieces for juveniles in particular that need to be reauthorized like today.
For folks who are not familiar with the O'Neill Institute and the Addiction and Public Policy Initiative, what do you do?
So we do two things. First, at the O'Neill Institute, we work at the intersection of public health and the law to advance evidence-based policies for people in a number of areas. Our areas are specifically focused on substance use disorder. We work a lot on the Americans with Disabilities Act to make sure that it provides protections to people with substance use disorder. And then I also direct and teach in the Master of Science in Addiction Policy and Practice program at Georgetown University's Graduate School. This is the first of its kind program in the country. And the purpose of this is to train people so that they can hit the ground running. It's a one-year program, so they can hit the ground running and have provide evidence-based policies at the state, federal, local levels. This is our third year. We have people who are working across the government in the private sector. And when they go into, it's not a time right now with over 100,000 deaths annually. It's no time for on-the-job training. So these people go in and they're prepared to have implement evidence-based practices.
And so what jobs do you foresee those people taking on the state or on the federal level? What do they become?
So policy analysts primarily. One is working at the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Another is working for the state of New York. Another is working in the state of Maryland. And another works in treatment, recovery. So, you know, these are positions, policy analyst positions, where, you know, they know what works and what doesn't, but they're also, like, looking, keeping an ear out, based on their training, for what might be around the corner, what the challenges that we might face, and how to best address them.
How long have you been working on this issue?
So I worked on it when I was the mayor's legal counsel in Seattle, but really full-time since 2009 when I joined the Obama administration.
Have we gotten better since 2009 on any front?
Yeah, I think we've made, we're not making strides as fast as we can, but I think there is a growing awareness that people with substance use disorder, stigma and shame don't cure people. And locking people up doesn't make people better. that we need to have, you know, evidence and science, but also compassion towards people with substance use disorder and address it as a condition that we know that it is a condition that can be prevented, treated, and from which people can recover.
When did we make that change on stigma? When was that recognition that this isn't helping to solve the problem?
So I think there's always been an undercurrent of people who have recognized the importance of reducing stigma. But when I was in the Obama administration, Michael Botticelli was our director of the office. He was the first drug czar who was in recovery from an alcohol use disorder. And he was on 60 Minutes. He really personified for a lot of people what the challenges they faced as people with substance use disorder. We changed the language of addiction the last year of the Obama administration. You know, there are terms that just add to the stigma and don't help anyone. So, you know, that change has slowly started to occur, and I really think it's speeding up with more and more people coming forward and saying, I am in recovery from addiction. Recovery is possible.
As the place to go to make changes on this issue, why did you leave the Office of National Drug Control Policy?
So I was there for a year. That was I was acting director. And, you know, the really great thing about this Biden administration has put in an MD, a doctor, for the first time as director of that office. So our drug czar is someone who comes from a public health background, who understands and treats addiction. So he's perfectly situated to address the issue nationally.
And what are those treatments that we are discovering that we're trying to get more into the pipeline?
So for opioid use disorder, there are, you know, three FDA-approved medications. So methadone and buprenorphine are the two with the most research science-based that reduce overdose deaths and help people enter recovery. For alcohol use disorder, naltrexone is a medication that is available. It's not as often used, but it is available to treat alcohol use disorder. We also have cognitive behavioral therapy, contingency management for stimulant use disorder. So, you know, we have treatments that work. We just haven't made them as available to people, and we need to continue to remove those barriers so anyone who wants treatment can get it.
That was Regina LaBelle, former acting National Drug Control Policy Director in the Biden administration. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.